Welcome, everyone. Welcome, both here and on our live stream. I'm Laisha Ward, EVP and Chief External Engagement Officer at Target, or Target, as I know many of you say, and I'll be your MC for today's session. And basically, I'm going to be introducing our amazing speaker because she's so incredible. She's going to be navigating and MCing a lot of the conversation herself. And on behalf of everyone at Target, I am thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women leaders from across Massachusetts and all around the country. At Target, our purpose is to help all families discover the joy of everyday life. And that's why we are proud to be a partner of this conference and to celebrate women and the leadership roles that you play every day in all aspects of your life, whether that's in your career, at home, with your family, or in the community. Today, we are in for an insightful and an inspiring hour with one of the most badass, or shall I say, brave women, Reshma Sajani. Reshma is a New York Times best-selling author and founder of and the CEO of Girls Who Code, which is an international nonprofit that's working to close the gender gap in technology. And thanks to Girls Who Code, today over 185,000 young girls throughout the United States, Canada, and the UK are changing what a computer program person does and quite frankly, what they look like. And that is inspiring, but also critical, quite frankly, for our global economy. Many of you may also know Reshma from her book, Girls Who Code, or watched her incredibly popular TED Talk, which really helps teach us, but especially young girls, that we must end our desire to be perfect, right? It sucks. And in fact, instead rewire ourselves to be brave. And through her own personal and professional journey, this is a woman who really knows how hard it can be, quite frankly, to step out of your comfort zone and into bravery. And so she's going to spend some time talking to us about what that looks like, stepping out of your comfort zone and into bravery. And today we get to hear more about some of those ideas and the practices that Reshma has not only applied herself but learned about in her work all over the globe so that we can be thinking about ways to ensure that we make bravery a lifelong habit, right? A daily routine. And in her words, be boldly ambitious, be relentless, and never give up. Also, Reshma and I, just moments ago, had a wonderful conversation for the Conference for Women's podcast, and it was my first opportunity to do a podcast, and it was such a pleasure. I felt like we were fast friends. She was one of my girls, a sister. We could have talked for hours, and so I am really excited that we'll have a chance to share that podcast with you next year, so you'll see that. And more information coming out about it. And I would encourage you to not only tune in to this wonderful conversation that you're going to be having today, but we'll have even more nuggets that we'll share on that podcast. So without further ado, please join me in a warm welcome for the badass, Reshma Sajani.
I was trying to convince Laisha to stay up on stage with me so we could continue this conversation, but I am now your newly anointed fangirl. She's amazing. Target 28 years, started working on a store in Water Street, thought she was going to the Peace Corps, and now you basically run the place. So that's essentially what happens when you embrace bravery, not perfection. So I think this is pretty much my 150th speech of the year. Yes. Thank you. You are basically standing between me and a week in Guatemala. So I want to have a lot of fun today, and I want everybody to kind of walk away from this conversation, hopefully looking at their life and their path in a different way. So I always say that I am first and foremost the daughter of refugees. My parents came to this country in 1973. They were 2 of 1,000 refugees who got status to come to this country. And the reason why they were able to come here was that they were engineers. And in the 1970s, this country was desperately seeking engineers. And my father, even though they were engineers, my dad worked as a machinist in a plant. My mother sold cosmetics. And every night, no matter how tired my dad was, he would sit me on his lap and he would read to me about Dr. King, Mahatma Gandhi, Eleanor Roosevelt. So from the time I was a little girl, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a change maker. I wanted to be a public servant. I wanted to give back to this country that had literally saved my parents' life. I grew up in Chicago, Illinois, and I graduated with $300,000 in student loan debt. Yep. And I did what every Midwest girl thinks she should do. I moved to New York City. I got a job at one of those fancy law firms, and I thought, you know, I will pay off those loans in a year or two. I'll work for the man for a year or two, right? And then I'll go do what I'm really meant to do. Yeah, right. So 10 years later, I find myself still working for the man, right? In a job I hated, in a life I didn't want. And I felt stuck. I was 33 years old, and I kept thinking to myself, like, is this it? Is this the rest of my life? And I remember I would come home every night to, like, a really large bottle of wine and way too much shopping on Gilt Group. And while I sat there one day at work, like, in this windowless conference room, my best friend called me, Deepa. And it's funny how your best friend always calls when your life is falling apart. And I remember just answering her phone and just crying. And I heard her say through my tears, just quit. Just quit. There was nothing profound about what she said, but there was something about hearing those simple words, like at that moment, that I just heard. And I decided to do exactly that. I quit. I walked into my boss's office and I quit. And instead of going to go get a real job, I decided that I was going to be a politician and run for office. So I ran for office for United States Congress in a Democratic primary against an 18-year incumbent because I thought that that was a great idea. I had like a 1% chance of winning a 1,000-page policy book. I remember the only thing my friends and I knew how to do was build a website, and we built one, and we raised like $50,000 from Indian aunties that were just so happy an Indian girl was running for office. But it was the best 10 months of my life. You know, I basically did what Ocasio did 10 years earlier, except she won and I lost. And so as I sat there on my victory party that never ended up happening, I remember I had gotten less than 19% of the vote. I had raised like $1.4 million on like 10,000 votes. Like, don't do the math. Like, it was humiliating. I was broke. I had pissed off the entire Democratic establishment for not waiting my turn, and I had no contingency plan. But as I woke up the next morning, the first thing that I thought to myself was, oh my God, I'm not broken. Like, I'm not broken. I had thought that for so long in my life that if I had tried something, if I had gone after my biggest dream, and it didn't work out, that it would literally break me. And the fact that I wasn't broken was this revelation, and it was the beginning of living my life brave, not perfect. It's what gave me the courage to start a movement to teach girls to code when I don't code and I didn't bother to learn. So girls who code for a minute, because this is kind of what got me into thinking about this idea about being brave, not perfect. So when you run for office, which I hope every single woman in this room does one day, when you run for office, you go to a lot of schools. And I would go into New York City public schools, and I would go into computer science classes and robotics classes, and I would literally see lines and lines and lines of boys, trying to be the next Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. And I remember thinking to myself, where are the girls? I mean, I knew that Silicon Valley was a boys' club, but I didn't know that that club started in high school. And it pissed me off. And I wanted to do something about it. So when I lost my campaign, I thought to myself, you know, of all the things that I saw on the campaign trail, what's the one thing that really moved me? And it was, again, seeing those lines and lines and lines of boys. And I realized, you know, that we're living at this moment. Maybe this clicker wants to work. Maybe it doesn't. Let's go back. We're living in this moment, right, where technology is a part of everything about the way that we live and work, right? There's 500,000 open jobs in technology. They're not just in Boston and Silicon Valley and New York City. They're literally everywhere. And when you think about what the solution is to creating more innovation, it's quite frankly getting more women to go into technology, right? And what's interesting about this technical innovation, I mean, if I tried to take away your phones for like a minute, you would all die, right? Like, we're so addicted and consumed by technology. So not only is that accelerating, but what's also happening with that revolution is that essentially that's happening at the same time that we are more and more dependent on women to be breadwinners. 43% of America's breadwinners today are women, and that was not the case even 10 years ago. You go into any county, town, home, or parish, it's women who are putting food on the table, right? Women who are making sure that the kids go off to college. But we are absent from technology. Essentially today, less than 18% of the technology workforce is female, and that wasn't always the case. So in the 1980s, if you went to any gaming camp in America, it would have been half boys, half girls. Did you all know that the world's first programmer was a woman? Ada Lovelace, right? So we went from an industry, unlike law, medicine, construction, finance, we went from an industry that was female to today, when you think about a technologist, you think about Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. You don't think about Ada Lovelace or Katherine Johnson. And so people always ask me, and the reason why it matters is it's dangerous. It's dangerous to have women missing from technology. Let me give you an annoying example. I am not wearing them today because I left them in my bag, but I love hoops. Wear them all the time. And when I'm wearing my Apple AirPods and I got my hoops on, what happens? Clink, 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 right? And the person on the line is like, yo, what is that sound? And you're like, it's my hoops, give me a minute. And you gotta take them off and continue your conversation, right? Annoying. Why'd that happen? Because nobody that is on the Apple AirPods team wears hoops, because they're all a bunch of dudes, right? So they couldn't have thought that this product that they created could have that impact. Really annoying. Let me give you an example that I would put in the dangerous category. One of my students recently reminded me that one of the top uses of Alexa in Google Home is by perpetrators of domestic violence to lock women out, to turn the music up real loud. Here's the thing. Again, because the creators of Alexa and Google Home and that team of engineers were likely had never been victims of domestic violence, they could not have even thought that the technology can actually be used in that way. Dangerous. Every day that goes by, another algorithm, another data set, another innovation is being used without our voices in the room. A way that you could really experience this is Lyft and Uber. There was recently a report that came out this week about the number of rapes and reports of sexual harassment on Uber. It wasn't until fairly recently that Uber put an option on their app to say, if this has happened to you, click here. Now, if any of us were in the room 10, 15 years ago when Uber was created, we probably would have told you should put that function on there ASAP. So again, there's so many things that are being created, that are being designed without our voices in the room. And so it matters. So I am on a mission to create parity. And so one of the questions that I get asked is, well, why? How did that happen? Why did you used to have, again, an industry that was predominantly female become one that was predominantly male? And so the first reason for this is culture, if you could put that slide back on, right? So in the 1980s, you saw the birth of what I would call the programmer, right? The dude in a hoodie who's sitting in a basement somewhere, he's drinking a Red Bull, he's staring at a screen, right? He hasn't taken a shower. And you saw him on Revenge of the Nerds, Weird Science, right? And so when I go talk to girls across the country and I say, what does a programmer look like? That's what they describe to a T. And the thing is that culture matters, right? If we have Barbie dolls that say, I hate math, let's go shopping instead. If I can buy a T-shirt at Forever 21 that says I'm allergic to algebra. If I watch Mean Girls, which I admit I watch on repeat, and she's got the sign where she gets an A on her math test, but she crosses it out for a D just to get the affections of a boy. If we have culture that tells us that technology, math, science is not for you, we can't be surprised when girls are opting out. The second thing that I now basically live my life talking about is this idea about bravery, not perfection. I'm 44 years old. And when I think about that little girl that was 13 that wanted to be in public service, and if I think about the amount of women that were in Congress, the amount of women that were Fortune 100 CEOs, the amount of women that were entrepreneurs, not much has changed, right? And I got asked to do a TED Talk, and I wanted to really think about, I live with teenage girls. I literally live with teenage girls. And I wanted to think about, like, what have I seen in my life, in my leadership, that might explain why the numbers of women in leadership don't seem to move? And I remember thinking about a story that every Girls Who Code teacher would tell me. We've taught 185,000 girls to computer program, and every girl that comes to Girls Who Code has never coded before. So during that first week when they're being introduced to computer science, everybody's on the same place, zero knowledge. And every teacher would tell me the same story. She'd say that first week when students were learning how to code, a student would call her teacher over. And she'd say to her, I don't know a code to write. And the teacher would look at her computer screen and she'd see a blank text editor. So if she didn't know any better, she thought that her students spent the past 20 minutes just staring at the screen. But when she pressed undo a few times, she saw that her student actually wrote code and then deleted it. So instead of saying, hey, look, I wrote this, I know it's not right, what should I do differently? She rather show her nothing at all. I give this TED Talk, 5 million people watch it, and it goes viral, and I am inundated with women who say, I do this too. Girls who say, I do this too. Dads who say, I do this too. And this do this too that I'm referring to is not just about deletion of code, but it's a metaphor for deletion of code in every aspect of their life. It's this idea of I give up before I even try. And so I decided to write a book and really try to understand, is there something to this idea that perfection is standing in the way of not just our leadership, but our joy? When did that happen? How did it happen? And can it be untaught? And so I want to start by showing you a video, a little bit about when it happens. And it's about lemonade.
I've been just sitting here making sure that this lemonade was ready for everybody. But I kind of wanted your help. Give me a bit of a taste and you can tell me how he thinks. I love lemonade.
Is that alcoholic?
No, it's lemonade.
No, alcohol!
What they don't know is that the lemonade has been spiked with a secret ingredient, a pinch of salt.
This lemonade task is a classic way of measuring empathy. First up, it's the boys. Are they going to tell the truth, or will they lie so they don't hurt Kate's feelings?
Oh, no! That is disgusting.
What, you don't like it?
No.
What do you mean?
It's too sweet. It's too sweet and I'm gonna sit tonight. I can't have any more sugar. I'm not having any more of that stuff.
Looks lovely. That is really disgusting.
Are you sure? You sure you don't want any more?
Makes me sick. I just don't want to drink it.
So the boys didn't mince their words. Now for the girls. Alice, Tiara and Sienna join Kate outside.
Have a taste now, so off you go.
It was a teeny bit too much lemon. I love the lemon inside it. I think it's incredible, but I don't like the lemon in it.
Oh, Sienna, well
how
done.
How polite.
I loved it, but I didn't like the lemon.
Alice, what do you think? Is it all right? Should I give it to everyone? I mean, I think it's delicious.
Even though I like it, please can I just have a drink of water now?
That's what I always say at dinner parties. I love it. It's fantastic, but I'm just a little bit full tonight.
There's a clear difference between boys and girls when it comes to empathy. As early as 3 to 4 months old, girls tend to be better than boys at reading emotions. The girls are clearly thoughtful about Kate's feelings.
So good, right? So what's so interesting is that the researchers are identifying the difference in behavior about empathy. We as women simply put other people's feelings before ours. I don't think that's what's going on. I think what we're witnessing here is perfectionism. The boys don't care about not only what anybody thinks, but they don't care about getting the answer right. They're just going to tell you what they think. The lemonade's gross. But the girls are doing this calculation in their head. Should I tell you what I really think? Or should I tell you what I think I'm supposed to say, which is that the lemonade is yummy? And we all can kind of watch that video and like see ourselves in those girls. The amount of times that we have chugged salty lemonade, right? To spare somebody's feelings or to basically say what we think we're supposed to say. And so how does that happen and why does that happen? So I'd encourage everybody at some point this weekend, and maybe not this weekend because it's really freezing out, but to spend 5 minutes at a playground and just sit on a bench and observe, and you'll see what I'm talking about. If you watch the way that boys play, they kind of just, their parents will tell them to climb to the monkey bars and just jump head first, preferably, right? But for girls, it's a different story. We say to them, be careful, honey. Don't swing too high. Did you take that toy away from her? Give it back. Is your dress dirty? Come over here. Let me clean you up. We are literally, from the moment of 18 months, we are wrapping our girls up with bubble wrap. We're cocooning them. And it starts in the name of physical protection. And then it extends to emotional protection. And it's a different story for our boys. And it's not something that we do intentionally. It's second nature. It's the way we've been raised. It's the way we're raising our kids. I have a 4.5-year-old son. And when I found out I was having a boy, I cried because it was so off-brand. But I'm okay now. But, you know, my munchkin Sean came up to me like 2 years ago, and he said, I'm afraid of the dark. So I dutifully went to Bye Bye Baby or Target, and I bought that nightlight. And so we'd go up the stairs, and I'd plug in his nightlight, and I'd go into my room. 3 minutes later, I'd hear my husband come up the stairs. He'd go into Sean's room, he'd pull out the nightlight, and then Sean would scream. And we would do this dance for like a couple of days. And finally I said to my husband, what's your problem? Sean's afraid of the dark. And my husband replies, my husband, my house. Right? Says, we got to toughen him up. We got to make him strong. And I said to Nihal, Sean, if Sean was a girl, would you let her have the nightlight? And my husband's like, ugh, you're right. I would. Right? So from the time our boys are little, we toughen them up. We make them into men. You know, we get them comfortable with rejection and failure. And we experience this, right? Sit at any bar and a guy will come in and he'll hit on you and you'll tell him to piss off and he'll just do it again, right? They don't care. They just don't care, right? Because they're comfortable with rejection and failure. And it's not that way for us. From the time that we were little, all of you who can probably remember that moment where you were bad at softball or gymnastics or swimming or dance and you came home and you cried about it. And what'd your parents do? They took you out of that and they put you into something else because they wanted to make you feel good, to feel proud, to feel loved, to feel successful. And so what happens is as we get older, we start getting addicted to perfection. And it has real consequences for our choices in our lives. And you see the consequences of perfectionism, quite frankly, on every aspect of our life. You see it in school. Studies will show that when young women get a B instead of an A in one class in their economics major, they drop out. One class. Whereas boys are like, I got a B. I should run for president, right? We see it in our health. Women are twice as likely to suffer from depression and anxiety than men. Our college campuses right now are literally rocked with a mental health crisis. And we even see it in work, right? Studies show, again, that men will apply for a job if they meet 60% of the qualifications. For women, 100%. We literally don't even apply until we can check off every single box. Here's the thing. If we are waiting to be perfect to lead, if we are waiting to be perfect to live, we'll never close the leadership gap. Never. And so while we continue to fight racism and sexism and structures that have held women back, we also got to give women strategies to thrive in the culture as it is. And this is the culture. And I think that the solution to perfectionism, I think that the way that you learn how to be imperfect is through bravery.
I've been just sitting.
Okay. Can you do the next slide? And I've seen this happen with my students. I've seen how bravery has become, how coding has become a metaphor for bravery, right? So all of them walked in there thinking, I can't code, and then they did, and then like, oh my God, what are the other things that I have told myself I cannot do that I can do? And so I literally live in the company of girls that I see do transformative things. You know, it's funny, we're living in this moment. And I saw that today by our president's tweets, where our leaders are literally behaving like children, and our children are behaving like leaders. And so if we can infuse bravery, guess what we get? We get young girls like Greta, who have the courage to stand up at the UN and speak up for what's right. We get young girls like my student Cora, whose father got diagnosed with cancer when she was 5 years old, so she built an algorithm to help detect whether a cancer is benign or malignant, because she wanted to save her father's life. We get young women like Anastasia, who grew up every day having to participate in a shooter drill and said enough is enough. And so when she got her degree to go to the University of Pennsylvania, she was 17 years old, she built a microchip So when it goes off in an area like a school, it alerts the police. I could literally tell you endless, endless stories about what bravery has done for my students and their ability to be change makers. And I think the same thing can happen for us. You know, I have, like I said, this is my 150th plus speech. I've probably spoken to over several hundred thousand people this year. And it's so funny because I always get parents who grab my book and they say, "Oh, I can't wait to give this to my daughter." And I say, "No, you read it." You read it. Because here's the thing. We somehow think that it's too late for us. I often think about so much of the complicated relationship between mothers and daughters is about unrealized dreams, right? Our mothers think that they sacrificed and did so much for us, and then when we don't live our lives the way that they think they should, there's friction, right? And I think all of that changes when we, whether we're 70, 60, 50, 40, 20, start embracing bravery and start doing the things that we want to do and start living the lives that we want to live. And so if this next slide works, we are going to talk about what a bravery practice looks like. So one of the things that I strongly feel is like we are literally living in this society right now where we are obsessed, technically obsessed, with what we eat, with what we drink, right? Half of you probably drank a green juice this morning and you ate some gluten or some dairy or didn't do one of those things, whatever's in vogue right now, right? But what we don't think enough about is about what does wellness for our minds look like? What are the practices that I need to engage with in with my mind to start rewiring myself for a different set of behavior? So the first thing is, before you can even do any of those things, you can't be brave if you're tired. You can't be brave if you're tired. How many women in this room are exhausted? Raise your hand. Every hand. We are exhausted. Exhausted. And I would beg to say in 2019, we are more exhausted than we have ever been. Regardless of whether you are 20 years old, a stay-at-home mom, or on your way to retirement. And there's something wrong with that. And the reason why I think we're so exhausted is because we don't put our self-care first. Most of you in this room, raise your hand again, probably have doctor's appointments, right? That you've put off for months, if not years. Because somehow it's become too selfish to go to the doctor. And so here's the thing. If you don't sleep, you don't eat, you don't rest, you don't take care of yourself, when you get that opportunity to make a brave decision, you'll never pick the braver choice. Never. And so you have to engage in your self-care. So I want to give you a tactic for that. You know, I often talk about my congressional run as like my first, you know, real dance with bravery. The bravest thing I've done in this decade. But when I think about the bravest thing I actually may have done in this decade, it was going to the gym. You know, after I had my first baby, I could not lose the baby weight. You know, breastfeeding, all lies, 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 right? And because of my job, I got to look at myself, and I hated it. I was way too much negative self-talk. And I knew that the best time for me to get to the gym was at 7 in the morning, but that was the time my baby was getting up. It was the time my dog Stanley wanted to go for a walk. Right? Best time for me, worst time for the family. So what I needed to do was get the courage to walk out of the door and be like, y'all figure it out. So when you start your wellness practice, I want you to pick something for you. And I want you to pick something that is at a time that is the most inconvenient for everybody else. I'm serious about this. That's how you learn, and that's how everyone around you will learn that you come first, right? Because it doesn't count when you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go for a run. So the first thing I have up there is to practice imperfection. Practice, practice, practice
imperfection. I think that we think that we have to do things perfectly. And I think when you do things perfectly, it eats a lot of your time up, especially your time for yourself. An example of this, emails. Emails, emails, emails. Most of you, if I gave you a challenge today, send an email with a typo in it to someone that's semi-consequential, not your spouse or your parent, your dog sitter, someone that matters. Y'all will be like, what? Because I know what you do. You reread and you rewrite your emails, 100 exclamation points, 90 emojis, over and over and over again. And we quickly go from, oh my God, there's a typo, to I'm stupid, to I'm dumb, to I'm going to get fired, all in about 10 seconds, right? That one thing, emails, take up so much time and emotional energy. And here's the thing. No one cares about your typos. No one cares about your typos. They're too busy focused on themselves. So there are so many things that you literally spend time doing because you feel like you need to do them perfectly, that I want you to take that time back. Another example of the cost of imperfection is that we lose our voices. Let me give you an example of this. I've been, I speak to a lot of people, as I already talked about, and I often speak to audiences that are half men and half women. And the moment's gonna come soon for us, but the moment will come where it's Q&A time. And what happens? First hand raised are men. I know. And what's happening with the women? What are we doing? We are writing the question down. We're thinking about it. We're perfecting it. We may be whispering it to the person next to us. And by the time you get the courage to open up your mouth, I'm in the car on the way to Logan, right? And what's happened in the dynamic in that room? The men think we have nothing to say because we never spoke. And we are pissed at ourselves because John said the same thing I was going to say, but I was going to say it much better. And we didn't get to contribute. And y'all do exactly this. I know I still do it, right? And it's if we could just learn to just put our hands up and ask the imperfect question, it would change the dynamic and it would change the way that we feel about ourselves. The second bravery practice that I want to talk about is this idea of doing something you suck at. Doing something you suck at. Now, to the extent I see some men in the room, yep, you can raise your hand, we like you. You may know exactly what I'm talking about. You probably, I don't know, golf, play basketball, something. Okay, you're raising your hand, you're shaking your hand, right? So a lot of men engage in this idea of doing something that they're not good at. Like, I love President Obama, he sucks at basketball, but he likes it, right? So he continues to play and enjoy himself. And you know that there's a difference between enjoying something and being good at something. For most of us women in this room, we've gotten those two things confused. We think that just because we're good at something, we should like it. And that started happening to us in like middle school, high school, definitely in college, right? And certainly in the workplace. Because many of us stay in jobs that we're good at that we hate. Many of us stay in relationships that are over because it works, right? So what I want to get people to think about is this idea of doing something you suck at. So each of you, I want you to pick something that you think that you will suck at and to figure out whether you like it. So for me, I've done surfing. I can't swim. I hate cold water. But I make myself every summer take a surfboard out into the beach, right? I'll watch a 5-year-old doing a handstand right next to me. It's embarrassing. I barely can get on the surfboard, but you want to know what? When I walk off that beach, I feel so damn alive. And dare I say, most of the people in this room don't know what that feels like anymore. Because we stopped a long time ago doing things that we enjoy just because we're not good at them. And we've stopped living. The last thing, and then I'm going to close, is this idea of just starting. I literally had an idea for Girls Who Code, and I thought, Girls Who Code, that's a great name. I went and bought the URL on GoDaddy.com, $1.99. Went to a dinner party the next day. What are you working on? Teaching girls to code? Oh, great, let me help you. I told too many people. I had taken too many steps, and then I just had to do it. And 8 years later, I built a movement. Most of you in this room have a Girls Who Code in your head, in your heart. Have something that you want to do, something you may deeply believe in, but you've talked yourself out of it. I want you to walk out of this room and just take one step. Buy a URL, tell a friend, write a business plan. Just start. And when you take one step, and it took me 2 years to do my first Girls Who Code program, but I felt like just by telling the universe that I was going to do this, it made me feel so much better that I wasn't hiding a secret or a dream and putting it off somewhere else. So just start. And now I'm just going to just be quiet. So we can open up the time for Q&A. Thank you guys so much. I'm going to judge you all so hard.
And we have mics in the aisle, so please come forward and line up, and we'll take as many questions as we can.
All righty. Do you want to start here?
She was.
You want to start there?
I can start.
Yes.
That's fine.
Great.
Thank you. So I'm so excited about some of the things that you said. I research and write about self-care and growth for moms from my site, Mom's Hierarchy of Needs. And something that I've observed with all the research is that when you try to do those things that are good for you at a time that's inconvenient for everybody else, you get a fight. And it does not come quietly. Mm. No one's going to give you that time. And being exhausted also means you stop fighting for yourself.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
So I'm curious to ask you, do you think that that fight is internal or external, or both?
Oh, I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think if your kids are young, they don't understand why mommy is going to go for a run or leave instead of cuddle.
Yeah.
And I think our spouses are not used to taking on 100%. Extra things in the home.
I think that's right, and I kind of feel like, F it. That's what I've been doing. No, I'm serious, right? Because I realize the problem necessarily isn't my son or my husband, it's me. I feel guilty. You know, and I often, like, so for example, I will take a red eye to get home at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then I'm exhausted. And, you know, my husband doesn't do that. And wouldn't even think about it, right? Yeah. I was telling you the story about how when I get upgraded on the plane after a long book tour, I'm like to my husband, hey, you take the front of the bus. And I'm like sitting there in the back, you know, 9 Paw Patrol episodes in, like 100 M&Ms in my face. And I have to have this dialogue with myself, like, why do I feel like I have to be a martyr? And it's because I feel like I'm supposed to be the perfect mom. And the perfect mom doesn't go to the gym. The perfect mom doesn't stay in a city and just go have pancakes by themselves, you know? Right?
Yep.
The perfect mom doesn't do these things. And so it's often not my husband who's saying, where are you? And my kid, yes, who's crying, but that's, you know, like what kids do. It's me. And so I've really tried to switch it up the past, like, year. And everything's fine. And I've eaten at a lot of great pancake houses. And I'm happier and healthier.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Maria, and this is my second year running Girls Who Code.
Oh! So, yay!
So I'm genuinely starstruck, and I want to say thank you. And I'm going to be selfless, and I want to ask you for a piece of advice that I can give to my middle schoolers about how to be brave, because when I read the book, I immediately was like, okay, girls, we're going to talk about this, and then immediately that same day, one of the girls erased what they created, and I was like, this is what I just talked about. So what piece of advice can I give to them from you on how to be brave?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that it's so important for them to get comfortable. I know this is going to sound weird, but it's almost like to get comfortable being mediocre, to get comfortable not having to do the best. And I think it like any time where you can make them sit with that discomfort of it not working out or it not coming together or not feeling good is like teaching them a lesson. Like we were talking about, I love Serena Williams. And if you think about why Serena Williams is so great, is she literally sits at the edge of her ability in a coach who's telling her, do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again. It's not personal. But you'll never be great unless someone tells you to do it again and do it again and do it again. And that means that you have to get a relationship, a very intimate relationship with failure and risk-taking. And if we can give that to our kids as early as we possibly can, I just think that we are going to see so much more leadership from them and happiness from them.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question's about double standards.
Yeah.
Because, so I was really struck by the statistic, which I think I knew, we all know, but to hear you say it was very validating, that, you know, men will apply for a job with 60% and women won't apply until they have 100%. But the other side of that is, you know, the people making the hiring decisions. There's that saying that women are hired for experience and men are hired for potential. And so, you know, so much of what you're saying today is like how we can do the things, send out imperfect emails, right? But the problem is, I mean, how do we deal with the reality that when we do something, right, when we send out an imperfect email, when we apply for a job that we only have 60% of the boxes checked, it's viewed differently, the repercussions are different than if it's, I mean, what do we do?
100%.
Just yell? Because, like, that's, honestly, that's what I do.
Look, I think it's like this double-edged, like, so Carol Dweck has this great quote where she says, if life were one long grade school, girls would rule the world. So we've been playing this game. We've been playing the perfection game for so long, and it's not working. No better example of this than the current presidential election. Okay? So we have to do something differently. And not saying that there is not going to be a cost to that. So right now in our society, failure is a privilege for white men. Let's be honest. Okay? Failure is a privilege for white men. And women are penalized more harshly for failure than men, and women of color are penalized even more harshly for failure than anybody else. But that doesn't mean that we have to just continue the status quo. I think that that means that we have to really have consciousness around this, and it often starts with us. I often think about how much we as women penalize each other when we act out in ways that are against our gender norms. And we have to pay attention to this stuff, and we have to start doing that differently. So when you're in a performance review, right, and all of us, and there might be a lot of managers in this room, and we're looking at Sue and Stuart, and suddenly they're doing similar things, but somehow it's okay if Stuart does it and not Sue, we have to call ourselves on it, and we have to just start changing the norms and start speaking up. I sent a tweet out the other day about, like, you know, I don't have people been following the whole Away CEO scandal stuff, right? So Stephanie's behavior was horribly wrong. But if you look at, you know, it was interesting to see how female CEOs are fired instantaneously when they make a mistake, whereas we have a lot longer of a tail. I mean, you saw this, quite frankly, with Kate Hill, the congresswoman, and with the governor of Maryland, right? And so we have to start changing what I think has become normal in society by calling it and by ourselves behaving differently. I know it's very unsatisfying. It's unsatisfying for me too, right? In terms of where we are right now, but we have to acknowledge it and change it. We just can't keep continuing to be perfect because it's not paying off.
Just to follow up on that,
yeah.
that whole 60-100% thing, I think if more of us do it, then it becomes the norm.
Yeah.
And it becomes acceptable. And then the other part of that is if we have 100%, we're going to be bored in 6 months. We have 100% of what's on that job list, and we apply for that job, and we get the job. We're like, woohoo! 6 months later, we're like, oh, I have nothing to learn. So I don't know. That's not why I came up here, but I just
yeah.
saw something that I wanted to say. What I did want to ask you was the lemonade video.
Yeah.
I was curious to know if you had any thoughts about if there was a plant of a kid, like a girl at the beginning of that row of 3-4 girls or whatever, that said, oh, this is horrible. What would the other girls have done?
Oh, it's such a good thing.
Right?
Yeah. You know, it's it reminds me, Glennon Doyle was telling the story about her daughter. She was like coming downstairs. Her daughter was over with all her friends or whatever. And she came down to the basement and she said, y'all hungry? And the boys just responded, yeah, I want this, I want that. And what the girls did is they looked at the one alpha girl to decide she was going to tell everybody whether they were hungry or not. And then proceeded to answer the question. Yeah. So that is a really, really, really good and interesting point.
Mm. Not that it changes the nature, but it just changes how people respond.
Yeah, and I think that the definition of a good girl, and I think this generation is a little bit different, but the definition of a good girl used to be the one that just said, please and thank you, and of course I'll drink it. And that was the model of behavior. And I think today, when you look at some of these young people to see what the modeling is, it's different. So I hope that they can influence each other to say their truth. Oh, hi.
Hi, I'm Jaya. I just had a quick question going back to a little bit of what you said earlier about taking a risk and trying. So I play tennis. I play tennis for my club. And I always have, and I'm better at it now. I used to suck. But I'm getting there. I've improved a lot. And when we play, towards the end of the class, around the last 30 minutes, we'll play matches. And we'll just practice with our teammates and just get to learn. And you get to ask if you want to play singles or doubles. And from there, they'll try to partner you up. But I always find myself asking to play against a girl instead of a guy because I find that they're... strength, I feel, I worry that they'll overpower me, or that even if I know they're better, I somehow worry that denial, or I'll worry that I won't be able to finish the match or something like that. So I was just wondering if you had anything, because I do want to be strong enough, and I do want to say that I can play against him, and I was just wondering if you had anything about that.
It's so funny you just said that. It reminded me, I'm on Harvard's board, and I was there this weekend meeting with the Women in Computing group. And the young women were telling me that they're in finals right now, and they were just telling me that at the end of the semester for CS50, they get to decide whether they want to work in groups or they want to work alone. And all the girls decide to work alone because they rather work by themselves than with the guys. And it's similar to what you guys see the parallels to what she's saying, right? It's like you're already assuming that they're better than you, that they're smarter than you, that they're more physically apt than you are. And so you rather... be put in a category where you feel like you can actually compete. I get to interact in my job with a lot of mediocre men. Gosh, I'm gonna get in trouble. But anyway, I have probably met some of the most powerful men in the world and spent real time with them. And I was telling these girls that when I was at Harvard, I remember I was this Midwest girl that went to Schaumburg. Everybody in my hometown went to a community school or state college, and I could not open my mouth when I was at Harvard because I just didn't think I was smart enough, that everybody was smarter than me. And one of the coolest things I got to do this year was give a speech between Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. It's the only woman, only person who actually was asked to speak and give an actual speech and not a fireside chat. And I remember sitting there thinking how much I belonged. and how much I belonged on that stage. And I was thinking, wow, how I had gone from that girl to this woman. And part of it is I have realized in my travels, in my experiences, that they're not smarter than us. They're not stronger than us. They're not more qualified than us. They have been socialized to never question their greatness. My 4-year-old tells me every day how smart he is, that he's smarter than me. Every day. I'm not kidding. And we, because we've been taught to be modest and humble and all these other things, are always questioning ourselves. And so to what my hope for you is to silence that voice and tell her to shut the fuck up.
Hi, Reshma. My name is Deepti. I'm a mom of 3 kids under 8, and I've had a dream to be a writer. I work a full-time job as well, so I always thought, you know, writing will be when I retire, maybe. But I see you've been doing things you never imagined, and you've also written a book. So can you share something about your journey, how you got started on that, in that direction, where I assume was also took a lot of bravery?
Yeah, and I think the other thing for me is maybe the older I've gotten, I'm afraid of regret and envy. I'm in my 40s, and I have a lot of my friends who stuck in that job when they had a dream to write, or who, you know what I mean, didn't chase the things that they knew that they were meant to do, and they're bitter. And I don't want that for me or the people that I love in my life, and I don't want that for you. And so I think part of recognizing is that sometimes it's now or never, right? And that you just have to do it. And I think we build up the fear of the unknown, and the fear of like leaving your job and being a writer, and what if nobody ever reads anything that I do? And we build this up that it's, like I said, we'd rather just give up before we even try. And so my thing for you is to take one step today. You know what I mean? Whether it's signing up for writing class, whether it's journaling every morning, like whether it's like committing to writing one thing, and just do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amazing.